This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology, now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnoffs, and this is the February Room.
I lost my father-in-law last year, Dennis. He spent his legal career defending the rights of the tribes of the Columbia Basin, people forever connected to the wild steelhead and salmon that define that region. An avid steelhead angler himself, the Deschutes River held a special place in Dennis's heart. Last year, my husband decided to pay his respects by fishing alongside one of Dennis's best friends in his favorite steelhead run. Not a few minutes in, Justin hooked and landed a gorgeous native hen, a fish that will be forever linked to his dad. Steelhead hold that kind of power over anglers, but tragically, returns of steelhead in the Columbia Basin are the lowest in recorded history, prompting a shutdown of angling on the famed Deschutes River and other tributaries. Now more than ever, these fish need advocates, such as my guest today, Josh Mills. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's kind of a somber tone to start the podcast, but it's pretty devastating what's going on right now. And I should also say, Josh, you're the development coordinator for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, but you're also on the board of Wild Steelhead Coalition.
Correct. Yeah, I've thankfully been able to form my life to try to do the best I possibly can for conservation measures, whether that be public land or, you know, the thing that holds the deepest part of my heart, whether it is anadromous fish and steelhead. So that's kind of where we are.
Well, and I think more than ever right now, with everything closing down, we have to remember how important these steelhead are. And I think to myself, I've never fished for steelhead, so I don't have this really close connection to how important they are. And I would love to hear one of your most memorable fishing stories for steelhead.
Oh, well, we have a litany of stories, but a lot of them, you know, involve time with my father. My dad's name's Faye Mills. He's 80, soon to be 81 in a few months. And he's my roll dog. He's the guy that goes with me 90% of the time. And he's still kicking ass right now through all of this and through age. He defies age as best as he possibly can. I just think a lot of the times I think about just the funny things, just the subtle things that have happened over the years, like I was telling somebody a story how last year we were on the Clearwater down upriver of Lewiston below Orofino, and we're fishing this run. And he had already caught a fish early in the day. As per regulation in our crew, if somebody catches a fish, they're in the end of the conga line at that point. They don't get first pass. So I'm coming through and swinging some flies. And then all of a sudden I see this giant fish jumping off my my left shoulder. We were on River Left. And my dad picked the hell out of my pocket. It was just like, you know, I had obviously already put a flies over this fish, and this fish is like, nope. And he latched onto this 17 pound hen attached to my dad's fly, and it's literally doing cartwheels, like 15 feet off my shoulder. I'm like, what in the hell? You know, just little things like that. Or I can think about one of the other funny times is we both like to tie flies, and he developed this fly that it was like, you know, like if people are out there who are steelhead anglers and they tie flies, there's the, the intruder style flies, two station kind of style flies. Well, he made this fly, and it was like the most backwards to typical construction flies. And he called it the dancing lady, and it resembled the long skirt on the back and then the front. But anyways, it was backwards to everything. And I looked at it, it was just like, ugh, that's awful. You know, it's like, no way. And so a lot of times we were fishing the Snake River as we moved up towards the mouth of the Grand Run. And he's like, you want to try it? And I'm like, no, not a chance in hell. So a little bit later in our first run, he swings two fish, you know, and I'm like, oh God, his ego is just going to go overboard. And then, you know, we go to the next run, he swings one. Finally, we get to the end of the day. The score was 6-0. And granted, this was on a better fish year. You know, it's just back in the early 2010, 11, 12, somewhere in that range. Anyways, and I'm just frustrated. I'm throwing all these beautiful ornate flies that I was very happy with, and I'm getting the middle fin. And finally, in the last run, he swings his seventh fish of the day on this stupid fly. And
the dancing lady.
Yeah, and then as soon as I lost it, I'm like, give me one of those stinking flies. And my first swing through the run, I catch one. And he's just sitting on the bank, giggling like a 10-year-old boy. It was fantastic.
So is that one of the first flies you use?
I hate that fly. I hate it. And you look at my dad's, like, when we're using sink tips and stuff like that later in the season, that it's just the dancing lady in versions 1 through 5 of variant colors. And I've got like 50 different flies of all different iterations, you know, and he's just got the same fly with different color combos. It's super funny.
Sometimes I think that's what's so amazing about fly tying and flies in general, is that some flies that you look in the box are like, no way. And then,
Oh yeah.
They tend to be like, the best ones.
Yeah. Like, and then, you know, a couple of years ago, early season on the Clearwater, we pull off, we're fishing, and everybody knows what this is. It's the cross from the paper plant. We also call it the stink hole in Lewiston. It's right in town. It's the first swing water on the Clearwater, and it's early season, like the second or so of August. And I had spent all this time tying these ornate muddlers with perfectly shaped heads on them and all this attention to detail. And my dad pulls out of his fly box and he's like, well, I think I'll fish this muddler. And I'm like, Jesus, Dad, did like a second grader with safety scissors like cut the head on that thing? It's all ragged and gross. And I'm like, and I should have known better, because, you know, I can't. So he goes through, and of course he lands about 12 pound hen. And then, wow. And then fast forward 366 days later, again, here we are in the same spot, like August 3rd the next year. And he's like, he pulls it out of his visor. He's like, I think I'll run this again. And I'm like, I'm sure you'll catch it. Yeah.
He's got some good mojo.
Dude is full of mojo for sure.
Well, Josh, I would love for you to kind of give a little bit more explanation of the current events of what exactly is going on with steelhead. Could you elaborate exactly for people who don't really know what's happening?
Absolutely. It's it's not just the Columbia right now. We have a term called distinct population segments that we're having issues all around the Northwest, up and down from Northern California up to BC. And so, because you can put your finger on something, if one river or if another, or if a state or something is having a little bit of problems, but we got problems. The Skeena is contemplating an entire shutdown, which is kind of the bastion of the North for steelhead country. The Columbia right now is on pace for one of the lowest recorded steelhead runs since 1938, when they started counting fish over Bonneville Dam. You know, it's a death of a thousand cuts. Typically, the four H's are what contribute to a lot of problems. So that's habitat, hydro, humans, and harvest. So, and then other things is that we've got some issues with changing oceanic conditions, because, you know, we can control all we can control from an in-river environment situation. And then, you know, if the fish aren't met with good conditions when they head out to the North Pacific, then we've got problems. You know, that all started, you know, we had really good, when I started fishing for steelhead around 2004, 2005. Picked up a spay rod in 2009, which is the biggest return in the last, I think, 20 to 40 years. I think it was 2009, there was like way over 600,000 fish over Bonneville. Typical 10-year average is anywhere from 250 to 300,000 fish over Bonneville Dam, which is the first counting marker on the Columbia. And so in 15, 16, we had some really bad in-river conditions. We had drought and really hot water. It really bottomed out pretty heavily in 28. We thought we hit the bottom in 2017, when it was just barely over 100,000 fish over Bonneville. So we're talking, you know, 30 to 40% of the 10-year average. This year on the Columbia, I've been watching the dam counts at Bonneville just kind of come on, let's go, you know, and waiting for these fish to start moving. And nothing was happening on that front end, because typically you start to see the front edges of the run come start in the 1st of May and start to move as through June, and it really starts to hit its peak. Around the first peak typically comes in the first week of August, and where we would normally have 2,500 to 3,000 fish over the dam, we were getting like 300, and it was just horrific to watch. You know, and the fact of the matter is, it's just that front edge of the run is looking really bad. It looked really bad. And, the alarm bell started to go off, and we needed to try to figure out, you know, what's going on. And, you know, the fact that we just, the deficit is so much right now on the front end of the run that even, I believe a really big rally at the back end of the run, you know, because everybody's like, maybe they're late. And conditions this year did mirror what happened in 2017, when we had 73 degree water at Bonneville, because everything's very, very temperature dependent, right? We had it was like nothing. And then all of a sudden we had a rally at the back end of the back end. But we shouldn't have to depend on a miracle for us to have a fishable amount of steelhead return to the Columbia Basin. You know, there has been some life in the last 10 days or so at Bonneville, because the temperature drop went from 73 to under 68 degrees. And so we had a couple of days, 1,700 fish, 1,600 fish, but really we should have 3,000, in my opinion. So yeah, it's there is some life right now there, but it's nothing to write home about, to be honest with you.
I mean, every time I see a steelhead picture, I mean, I really look at the fish. Because you have to imagine the journey that fish has gone on. I mean, it's really the story of life, right? To try and make it to the top, you know, and the fact that someone can catch. And I remember we had someone, and this was a while back, that in a mile stretch of water, there's probably, and this was a while ago, this was like, there's probably one steelhead in there. I mean, you think about that. That is incredible. And to have the opportunity to catch one of those fish on their long journey is, it's pretty remarkable.
It really starts from, you know, one of the reasons I fell in love with the fish is so much a number one, you know, salmon and steelhead are as David James Duncan says, to see if I can get his quote right, that salmon and steelhead are the Eucharist of the Northwest. Especially from a tribal standpoint, you know, and First Nation standpoint. But also I look at it as the incredible story that starts from the moment they burst out of their egg sacs, because you have a fish that is, as we like to say, is ultimately a plastic fish, because it has so many different life cycles and so many different expressions of life histories that whoever you call the creator or whatever, a god or whatever, has given these fish the ability to weather and withstand some pretty crazy things, right? So genetically, trout, just regular old trout and steelhead, there's nothing different with them. There's absolutely nothing. There's just a portion of their genetic code that gets turned on, and especially a little more females, go to the ocean and get big. So then, you know, you have some juveniles that will spend 1 year, 2 years, 3 years in a river, and sometimes even more, depending on the makeup of a river system. And here's another weird factoid. Steelhead down migrate backwards. They point their nose upstream and paddle backwards to the ocean.
What? I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. So they down migrate that way, right? So and now we've stacked the deck, especially with the lower Snake River dams. We're talking specifically within the Snake River system. They have 8 major dams to cross, and then they go out to the ocean. We don't know exactly where they go. And then guided by smell and telemetry and just about any other voodoo science that we don't know anything about, they come back to the river of their origin, right? And then here's the other part about this too that's crazy, is that some steelhead go out to the ocean, spend 6 months. Some spend a year. Some spend 2, spend 3. And, you know, I don't know if there's any for salt, but, you know, you've got a situation where you've got a fish that maybe is a 2 salt fish, a 10 to 14 pound fish will come back, and then it'll come in there. And, you know, to spread genetic diversity, that let's say a 14 pound hen typically will mate with multiple partners, mm-hmm. as well as in river, just rainbows, males that are sexually mature can come in fertilize eggs. So you have multiple eggs in a basket. You don't have all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I can provide some solace in a front end of this, a friend of mine, Chris Wickey, was talking about, he's like, God has given these steelhead a ability to withstand just about anything. And long after we're gone, if that ever mm-hmm. happens, there's going to be a fish that goes out to the ocean and it's going to come back. And it's going to figure out a way to become a steelhead again and repopulate these rivers, because the code is there for them to be able to do that. We've just been impeding the hell out of them for, 150 years.
Why do you think it took? I mean, it seems like the numbers have always kind of been really low. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it took this long to finally be like, hey, stop, like, let's take a moment? And on that note, do you think it's going to take longer than just this season, just to hit the pause button?
You know, and so much about this is it's an intensely politicized fish. It is, you've got multiple jurisdictions, you have tribal, you've got 3 states, you've got multiple user groups, and everybody wants a piece of the pie, right? So, we're still waiting for the state at this time. Here we are as we record today on the first day of September of 2021, we're still waiting for the state of Washington and state of Idaho to get off their butts and figure out what they're going to be doing. The initiatives, the things that the state of Oregon and ODFW has decided to do is a start. But, you know, we still have a lot of conflict and a lot of problems, but a lot of it is just, you know, what can people do? You know, a lot of it is just like, I get frustrated because people are like, well, I can't do anything about it. But I'm like, I think if we change the tenor, I think if we remind ourselves that this isn't, you know, steelhead are never a fish of multiples of giant numbers, like salmon that come in these giant rushes and can be overwhelming. Steelhead are kind of on the edge. They're kind of a mysterious fish. They're really not that hard to catch. It's just a matter of finding them and getting in a fly or a bait in front of them. It's just a matter of, we just don't have a ton of them. And that's the thing. And, you know, it's changing the tenor. It's realizing that you don't have to catch 12 a day to have a great day. You know, you don't have to do it. And, you know, I'm guilty of that. I've had days where I swung 10 fish and, you know, what does that mean? Do I need it for my ego? And there's a lot of doing this. And back to your original question of, is 1 year enough? I don't know. because, you know, we're always, there's always a little bit of the voodoo science that kind of goes associated with what's coming, you know, because next year we're going to be, you know, in 2022, what were the out, especially with the, within the Columbia, what were the out migrating conditions of 2019 and 2020? And even into late 2021, because these because some of these fish don't spend a ton of time in the ocean, and some spend 2 years, you know, were they met with good conditions on the North Pacific? Because that's one thing with the North Pacific current, that it brings deep upwelling of very, you know, because like back in like 2008, 2009, and 2010, where there's spectacular oceanic conditions and met with great in-river conditions for the ones that came back and the ones that are out migrating. So the good thing happened, and these fish are fighters, and they can bounce back. Thankfully, that's good. I don't know how long it's going to take. I just think we need to understand that we have a finite resource, and we just have to be as best stewards as possible, as best we possibly can, from an individual standpoint, all the way through to a state department and federal level as well.
Well, and I think what's the hard thing about, you know, people want to take pauses with everything, it's because with passion comes with experience, right?
Absolutely.
I love trail running because I experience it and I like getting up to the top. Mm-hmm. And it's also like, how do we keep the community loving steelhead if they don't get to experience being on the water and catching them? And I haven't experienced that. And I've had people on the podcast who just love steelhead. And I want to feel that. Like, I want to experience that feeling of having a hen on my line and seeing her and seeing the journey that she's came on. So I understand how some people are like, we need to keep people being interested in these fish. I remember, I think on your post, you said we need to get off the sidelines. So as somebody who hasn't experienced steelhead fishing, sure, and doesn't really know what to do, like, how can I help recover these fish so I can experience it and have more of like a, be an advocate? Because a lot of people probably haven't fished for steelhead.
Yeah. And, you know, I invite people to experience it, especially when, I mean, there's nothing better for me than when I take somebody for the first time, teach them how to swing a fly. And then all of a sudden, their world is rocked by a fish that absolutely just destroys them. I think about my buddy, Billy Hubanks, like, his wife bought him a guided trip a couple of years ago. And, my buddy, Kelby took him, and I was fortunate enough to come, and it was his first time he'd caught fish on a single hand rod, you know, nymphing, which is totally fine. But there's something special about just getting your arm yanked off, and when you get connected. And I remember Kelby and I were sitting on the bank talking, and we had given Bill a lesson in spey casting that day, and he was just an absolute natural. And we're getting towards the last run, and we were just jaw-jacking on the beach, just waiting, and Billy's swinging. It just so happened to be the place I caught my first swung fly steelhead 10 years prior. Wow. And I looked down, and he's absolutely just getting tornadoed by a fish. And I'm like, you're supposed to yell, man, when you caught a fish on him.
We get down to him. Don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're not excited, you're not invited. I mean, let's figure this out. He's like, and, you know, he is so focused and so freaked out. I can see the, like, terror on the inside. I mean, this is a guy that's a Purple Heart recipient. This guy is, wow, you know, he's a dude, you know. And,
yeah.
And he, you know, finally we get that fish landed. And I've never seen an adult man, like, shake like that, you know, because it's just something. It's kind of that inexplicable, how does a fish... a slimy, stupid fish affect a person and an adult like that. It's such an amazing thing. And so, you know, how do you get involved, right? And I think it's number one is understanding the state of affairs. So becoming, I think there's, for the folks who are curious, I think one of the things you can do is really try to understand what's going on and not to put the wool over anybody's eyes, to understand that we've got some bullshit we're dealing with right now. And in terms of, you know, depressed populations and so on and so forth, right? So get to know the state of affairs. Number two is become engaged with, I think anybody, I would also invite people to find the group, find the conservation group that, that speaks to them the most. For me, it was the Wild Steelhead Coalition, because a great group of people that really punch above their weight and try to be, as the Lorax says, the voice for the trees, but we try to be the voice for the steelhead, you know, and try to, you know, let science lead our way. And do as much impact. There's other great groups out there like Wild Steelheaders United. There's the Native Fish Society. There's Northwest Steelheaders. There's plenty of, you know, wherever you are in steelhead country, whether you're in Southern California or you're in Northern BC, or if you're in Arizona, you know, if you find a passion for it, it doesn't matter. See how, what are the work projects? What are the things they're advocating for? What are some of the action alerts that you can participate in, you know, all these different things will be there to engage upon. You know, if there are some rivers that are open, I would encourage a person to go fishing. Absolutely. You know, catch and release mortality is luckily, and if you do it right and fight them properly and all that, things like that, you know, it's sub 3% on most times. But, you know, if you, Let's say you go steelhead fishing and you catch two. Maybe you, it's okay for you to, that's enough for the day. Maybe it's two or three, or, you know, but not feeling like you have to catch every fish in the river. Because it's, again, these aren't bass. These aren't stock trout. We are lucky in certain river systems to have enough that were available to fish. So, you know, that's one thing. And then the other part about this is, get to know who your game and fish officers are, get to know who are the commissions, get, and just engage, just, you know, right. Be a person who is up on the subject and pull the wool from your eyes and understand what the hell's going on. And I think that's the number thing is you know, it's to be said that for folks to stop fishing, the river will lose advocates.
Right.
And that's true. And that's going to be true. But we're in a state that right now, a state of affairs where we just don't have excess fish to screw around with within this run. Because there's a term called escapement. And escapement is the number of fish that a river, a basin or a river needs to be able to reseed the next year, to have enough adults to put on the on the gravel that will allow fish to come back in the following years. We're teetering on the level right now that we don't have enough fish to meet escapement. At least I haven't seen what are the escapement goals for the Snake River Basin. But I'm telling you right now, when we typically see 100 to 150,000 fish over Lower Granite, which is the last dam in the Snake River system, we're not going to make anywhere near that this year.
Yeah. Well, and it's okay to be patient and wait. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like I think we teach our kids how to be patient. Like, be patient.
And now a brief message from our sponsors. FlyLab Reels provides silky smooth disc drags at a click and pawl price. Paired with Mid-Arbor Spool for quick line retrieval, the FlyLab family of fishing reels is the best value on the river. With four models to choose from, priced from $99 to $249, you won't find these reels anywhere other than the local CD dealer or at cd-fishing.us. And remember to go fishing.
I love fighting fish, and we just came back from Wisconsin, and I've never fished smallmouth before. And these are the, and these were like really, they aren't like lake smallmouth. These are on the river. It was like beyond, blew my mind. I was like, told my husband, I was like, why have I not fished for the, I'm not going to go back to like rainbows and trout. Like, I want a fighting fish. Oh, yeah. And so my husband, he goes, you would love steelhead. Are they pretty fun fighting fish?
Oh God. Let me give you back off for two stories, something that kind of in my mind, and I'll circle back to that question too as well. Absolutely. They're fighters. I think about, like, it's okay for us to take a pause, like what you were saying. I'm going to be hell on pheasants and chukar and on geese and ducks and probably spend my time, because I always want to be outside, right? I mean, if I can't be on the Grand Ronde or the Snake or the Clearwater, well, I'm going to find my ways into, you know, maybe do a little more deer hunting, maybe a little bit more trout fishing. And then the other thing is, just like you were saying, especially at the Columbia and the Snake River systems, we have an overabundance of bass. So turn your attention to the invasive bass, you know,
right?
Go fishing for them. And the other thing is that those things turn into two delicious fish tacos. So, you know, I'm never opposed to that. Let me tell you that much. I got some bass from the Grand Ronde in my freezer right now that will be making its way to some coconut oil here soon enough.
Amazing.
And then back to what you were saying about in terms of the fight. And that's the thing that people really will lose their mind for. It's this cat and mouse game that you end up playing with these fish from steelhead perspective, because it's like you have some that rise and are just savage and take a skater off the top, a skated dry fly. And then, like, I think about the fish that I caught last year on the Clearwater. When I hooked up, it looked like a 10-inch brown trout taking a trico on the Missouri. It was just, you know, just barely off the top. And then they sometimes, you know, so this, I think I've got like this, like, you know, sub-adult, maybe 15 to 20-inch rainbow who never went out to the ocean. And it turned out to be a 36-inch wild hen.
Wow.
That as soon as I got it, it like woke up and it went ape shit. You know, it probably jumped six times. And I don't think I've ever seen line disappear off my reel as fast as those things. And they just absolutely rip and burn and go. And it's not because they're just big, you know, like I've heard stories of, like, you know, guys who fish for pike or muskie, and they're looking for the grab and that first initial thing, because
right.
They're really not, you know, something that is excessive fighters. But, you know, steelhead can absolutely just beat your ass. And I think that's, and then like I've had some that I've like tussled with and I don't even know what happened. And they spit the fly after running for like, you know, 150 feet. And you're sure it's on. And then all of a sudden it's just gone. And you're like, what? Yeah. Or then you have times where, like, you know, it's, you know, I think steelhead are inherently a very curious fish that don't have any hands. And so what do they have? They've got their mouth. You know, something comes by and they pick it up and they want to, and this is just my own guess, you know, and other people hold this belief. But you'll have times where they absolutely almost take the rod out of your hands. And then other times it feels like a mouse, a cat playing with a mouse, who's just kind of swatting at it a little bit. You know, like, well, you'll have these little grabs. And then, you know, it's like, okay, well, it didn't want to eat that fly, so I'm going to come back. And then you change. One time I changed flies five times on a swing because it just wouldn't commit, but you knew the fish was coming up and tapping at it.
Yeah.
And then you put the right magic, you put the right coin in the slot, and boom, you're off. And
that is the best feeling.
Oh.
It's almost like you're like, I figured out the puzzle. Like, I figured
yes.
it out. I
yes.
it was
yes.
yes. And then you feel like you're the best angler in the world. Like,
I am the greatest.
I knew what it wanted. It just took me four tries. Because when you lose a fish, I swear, I feel like I never blame the fish. I always blame myself, like what I did wrong. Like, oh, you didn't let it run long enough, or you didn't, like, you know, gosh, when I catch one of these smallmouth, and it was huge. And I haven't really practiced, probably because I haven't caught a big enough fish. I just always kind of normally strip it in, and I need to take it to the reel. And my hand, my fingers were burning from, like, you know, stripping the line. And I was like walking towards the bow of the boat, and Justin's like, what? Doing? I'm like, I'm trying to bring in this fish. He's like, you need to figure out how to, you know, get the fish on the reel. And I was like, okay, well, I've just never caught a big enough fish where I need, like, they're all pretty complacent, the fish that I've caught. Like, they're very nice and they're calm. And the smallmouth, I was like, I literally put the rod over my shoulder and started walking with it. I was like, I don't know what to do. He's like, you look ridiculous. I'm like, I didn't say I was going to be good at this, but it sure as hell was so much fun. And I can't wait to have that experience with steelhead.
Yep.
And I can be patient. I can sit and wait. I think what also, and I don't mean to, you know, I think what's also really hard is, you know, steelhead is also a moneymaker. I know that there's guys that depend on getting people on the water, and I don't know what they need to do. I don't know if there's like a guide relief program that they can just, like, hey, sit tight. Like, you can be taken care of too while we take care of these other resources, because we just don't want to love it to death.
Yeah. Another story just came up, and don't let me forget about that guide question you had. But in terms of being patient, and just I want a quick story for those who may not know this story about the Elwha. And the Elwha is a river on the Olympic Peninsula just outside of Port. Is it Port Angeles? I think it's just out of Port Angeles. I may get my towns mixed up a little bit. Anyways, they had two major dams on that system that were derelict, and they took them out. I forget, you know, it was like 2013, 14, something like that. I get my dates a little bit. I'm paraphrasing. Anyways, the headwaters of the entire stream were inside the Olympic National Park. So never subject to any rainbow stocking. And so everything above those dams were pure genetic rainbows that were endemic to those rivers. So the thought was, they only had, but below the dams, I think they had like 3 or 4 miles to the mouth of the ocean. And so there wasn't any summer steelhead. And typically on the Olympic Peninsula, there's not a lot of summer steelhead. They tend to be more winter steelhead there. But anyways, this became a petri dish, if you will, for recovery. And this is a little bit different, but it speaks to the resiliency of steelhead. And what happened was is that the biologists and people like John McMillan and other leading scientists were like, our bet is those fish will turn anadromous within a life cycle. And so what they did with, I think it was, in my dates are a little bit off, but I think within about 2 or 3 years, they started to see significant numbers of summer run steelhead in the Elwha. So what had happened is these fish went, the bell was rung for them who had never been to the ocean before, went out to the ocean, got big, became steelhead, and came back. And I think within, again, the dates are a little bit off, but I think it was in 2018 or 2019, they did snorkel surveys, and their estimates, there was near 2,000 summer run steelhead who had populated that river, not from out of basin, not from other river systems, but from the fish that were behind the dams. So, you know, they called that story rising, you know, the Phoenix Rising, because these sons of guns hadn't been able to become anadromous for well over 110 years, 120 years. And so, you know, that genetic code, if we just get out of these sons of guns ways, a lot of the times, you know, and that speaks to, you know, like, and we can talk about this later, but the lower Four Snake River dams are kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. So back to the guide thing. And I, you know, this is something I struggle with, because, you know, I got my start from going with guides. And I still go with guides to this day. A lot of my friends are amazing guides, steelhead guides, and our trout guides or whatever. My conundrum becomes my love for my friends, but at the same time, these steelhead and salmon and anything that use these river systems are a public resource. You know, we can't have a tragedy of the commons here, because that's what we're staring at. And so I wrote an article, and maybe I'll send it to you. You can put it in the show notes or whatever, but it was, it's called, What Does the River Owe Us? And What Do the Fish Owe Us? And I tread lightly with this subject, but because I feel for folks, I was talking to a guy who's been guiding for 30 years on the Grand Ronde system, and he's very conflicted this fall.
Right.
You know, and the likelihood is he's going to get shut down by the state anyways. But I mean, there's become a moral issue of, what do you do when there's not enough to go around? It's a public resource. A kid in Bellingham, there's an old guy in Spokane, there's a person in the Tri-Cities of the state of Washington, and there's somebody in Kamei or Orofino. They're all our fish. They're not one guy's fish. And just because when the resource is down, I don't believe people have a right to make, you know, to continue going, and in the face of a situation where we can all look at it and objectively say, we need to pull back. And so I hope there is some guide relief programs. I don't know any at this point. And they're stuck in a rock in the hard place because a lot of guides became guides to be able to show their passion to other people. And granted, it is a money-making situation. Mm-hmm. But I look at my friend Jeff Hickman, who's one of the biggest names in all of Steelhead. He has lodges on the Dean River in BC. He has got an operation called Fish the Swing, which is also does tent camps and guides almost every day, typically on the Deschutes and the Lower Deschutes. He decided to forego an entire season from late July. Moving forward, he gave up all of his dates. He basically shut down his guiding fleet of three guys who are, make a majority of their income. It's probably well north of six figures of guiding income between the company itself.
Right.
But he is leading by example and he's putting money where his mouth is. And, and some people are just going to have to understand this is not the year to break the back. This is not the year to shoot the last buffalo. We're not in that situation, but it's like, Lord help us if we are. But, this is not the year where we can assert right. I believe, again, I'm going to underscore to my friends out in the guiding community is that I feel your pain. I feel all of our pain in a collective tornado of shit that we're all having to take a bite out of right now. The hope is that this is temporary. God help it if it isn't, but I hope it's temporary.
Well, and I think you make a really good comment. You said about this being like a public resource. And I think sometimes we get confused just because it means public and it's open to everybody doesn't mean that we can use it all the time. And I think with also backcountry hunters and anglers, as the development coordinator, you probably see is that, hey, we have public access and we want everyone to access these resources in this land and these waters. Mm-hmm. But we also have to make sure that we can keep those being public access because if we start depleting everything, no one's going to want to go there, like elk hunting. And, like we also have to be stewards for our own.
That's the word. That's the word right there. We have to be stewards. We have to be able to look at it from a macro level down to a micro level. We have to look at it from basin to basin. We have to go, what's going on in the snake? The North Umpqua, thankfully, which is also one of the preeminent streams in all of Steelhead. I mean, that's the land of Zane Grey and other places, that made famous over the years, and Frank Moore and all these people that are, on the pantheon of Steelhead fishing. They shut down till December 1st. Typically, that's one of the best places in the world to go, but they saw the writing on the wall. So the biologists and everybody went in, it's like, let's shut this shit down, because we have to be stewards about this thing. Right. We have to keep the seeds there for future generations. We can't keep pushing and kicking the can down the road. We just can't.
And I have a question because I know Steelhead are in trouble. I'm not very like, so you say summer Steelhead, winter Steelhead. Mm-hmm. Our winter Steelhead is just in trouble as a summer Steelhead? Like, do we need to be concerned?
It has a lot to do with the number one is they spend a lot of time in river. So they're subject to predation. They're subject to a long, they spend 1 to 3 to 4 years in the river, right? So they're subject to a lot of things like other fish, like pinks or chum or anything like that. They're born in the river and they get flushed out to the ocean, right? So they're just not as subject to what's the other multitudes of factors, right? We have a real problem with the hydropower system on the Columbia. It's mostly on the lower snake, the lower four snake river dams. But you have things like over on the Olympic Peninsula, which is quote unquote the last best place. They're missing escapement goals year after year on a lot of the famous rivers like the Ho and the Bogie and the Kalawa and all these other places. And thankfully last year they over there, for instance, they took some preventative measures and it was very controversial. But they took the option to be able to fish out of a boat because it provided you need to provide some fish some in river refuge and the ability to not be harassed at all times. But the winter steelhead are in a very similar boat. And winter steelhead, just for the general public, are fish that enter typically into the river systems, which are more coastal and by variety. I think the Lewis River is the farthest upriver of the Columbia. I could be wrong. I get this wrong sometimes. But like on the Columbia, there are some tributaries lower in the system where winter steelhead come in. But most of the time, winter steelhead are in shorter, higher gradient coastal rivers like the ones on the Olympic Peninsula, the Oregon coast, like the Nestucca or Nehalem, down the way down to in Northern California with the Russian and the Eel and stuff like that. And of course, some river systems have both summer run and a winter run fish as well.
Wow. I mean, it's just pretty incredible. Either way you put it, these fish are, they are incredible. And I hope that, you know, in the very beginning, I talk about Justin and his first catch after his dad passed away. And I swear, looking at that picture, I always look at the steelhead because it did look just like the sun hit him perfectly. And, and it's almost and you do feel like you just touch something that's, you know, your journey of life in general. Before, you know, I'd love to hear just one more great steelhead fishing story so that way people can just, you know, remember how beautiful these fish are and remarkable.
Oh, here's a great story. Here's a fabulous story. Okay. So Dad and I are on the Clearwater with my good friend, Ryan Bailey, and we're moving along and we fish this one run and I catch at that time, my biggest steelhead to date. He was a 16-pound buck that was perfectly wild, amazing fish, and absolutely just crystal perfect example of an inland summer run, B run. You know, it's something that has been out in the ocean 2 or 3 years, and just hefty, big fins are perfect. Like this is the top of a stinking mountain, right? So we got like an hour left in the day because it's like December 26th, which is in our family and amongst our friends, it's kind of almost a little more of a holy day because we always try to go steelhead fishing on December 26th, and it's always been really good for us because we thankfully blessed with good weather and the fish are in and usually we do pretty well on that day. Anyway, so back to this day, and this is another dang story about Old Man River, my dad. Besting me, but this is one of the better ones that I've seen. So, here I am. I'm on top of the god dang mountain right here. I'm just like happier than a clam. I'm in the back of the conga line. I'm third, and all of a sudden I see my dad hooked up, and the sun is setting, and it's just perfect and everything. But I can tell he's just got an absolute giant of a steelhead. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? You couldn't give me a half a stinking hour on the top of the mountain here. And he ends up landing a 42-inch buck. And for those that have fished the Clearwater, there's a special run of fish called B runs that are the top of the echelon, some well north of 20 pounds. And this thing is absolutely kicking his ass. And I'm just. Excuse the tame. I'm MNFing the guy the whole time up and down the bank because that's just like, are you freaking kidding me, Dad? And my buddy Ryan is just laughing and having a great old time. Finally, after about 10 minutes, he gets this thing, and it was 42 inches wild buck, double red band stripe, huge fish. And I'm like, really? You couldn't give me 25 minutes on top of the mountain, you son of a gun, you know? But it's that camaraderie. But we've got this great picture. I'm holding the fish and he's standing next to me, so it's fun. And I also think about my friend Ryan. I think about the first time I took him swinging on the snake, and he's so excited. He hooks this fish. And he starts lifting the rod, and he's like, "Fish, fish, fish!" And then he
starts walking backwards.
He eventually kind of pulled it out of the fish's mouth, and it was just a goof. And he's turned into one hell of a steelhead angler. But I think it's the blend of community, it's the blend of brotherhood and sisterhood, it's the blend of friendship, along with the rivers and the environment. And all the things that go around that I just have latched on to, and I will fight my ass off to make sure that it's still there when I'm 80, like my dad.
Well, I hope I get the opportunity to go fishing. If not, I'm all about saving these amazing fish because steelhead, I think that they kind of resemble a lot of like life journey. Like I've said numerous times on this podcast, but I do, I'm always like, man, those, I mean, if you think you've gone through a hard time, I mean, I'm scared of the ocean and those things, those things made it. Like, I mean, there's so many scary things. Like I think about that. I'm like, they probably have seen some really scary things in the ocean and then they make their way up. Yeah. And it's pretty, I mean, it's really incredible that like, I mean, determination. And like you said, in their brain, they're like, we're going to make it and I'm going to make some babies and then I'm going to say, see you later. I mean, talk about a life of just, of cause, you know?
And I think about, you know, I think what an intelligent system that was designed with regard to, I mean, here you've got these little fish that go out to the ocean and become this marine protein delivery system, both salmon and steelhead coming back in and just like the DNA of salmon and steelhead exist in the trees. And just, it's such a beautiful symbiosis that we need to keep going.
Well, you know, you think about it, they should probably have done, instead of Finding Nemo, they should probably have done a steelhead story. Cause I mean, gosh, that could have been like a total life journey. I mean,
oh my God.
The clown fish. I mean, they could have had a steelhead story. I mean, I bet. Oh. Okay. If Disney starts taking off on a steelhead fishing story, we all know where they got the idea, right here with you and I, Josh.
Yes, Lauren, it is. We will trademark that immediately.
I'm going to trademark it right now. I'm going to start thinking of some names for it. Josh, if people are wanting to learn more about steelhead and maybe have some questions for you, because you're so well, you're such a huge advocate, what's the best method for people to reach out to you?
Sure. Well, first thing I'm going to point you towards is the Wild Steelhead Coalition.
Yes.
And that is the group that I advocate for and I'm on the board for. You can find them at wildsteelheadcoalition.org. And you can also find them on Instagram. I suppose the easiest way to find me is on Instagram, is at MillsFly, MillsFly. And, you know, if anybody reaches out to you, Lauren, I'll give you my email address so that anybody can reach out to me. Because if we can inspire, if we can educate, if we can help and turn more people into advocates, we're doing our job.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.